a salmon state at one time, but now it's a almond and a pistachio and a big ag state for export. And it would be much better to use that water to have sustainable fisheries.
Oh, would have much healthier rivers and the ecosystems of the valley itself would be much healthier.
Yeah.
If we had salmon in the rivers rather than nut trees on the land.
Exactly. That sums it up very well, Ron.
Anyways, we are out of time, Dan, but I will end with, you are correct. There will be more eyed eggs put in the river at Edina this year, and that co-stewardship agreement between California Fish and Wildlife, NOAA, and the Winnemem Wintu is just about finalized. So it's going to be a three-year project to continue to reintroduce winter run Chinook into the cold water of the upper McLeod River and look at a swimway to get the fish around the dam and also bring back the New Zealand salmon, the original McLeod genetic salmon.
That's very, very important.
Yeah, so it's all in the works. It's all in the works. And we are out of time. Thanks again, Dan, and looking forward to the next time we can have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
All right, Dan.
Bye-bye.
And you've been listening to 90.1 FM KZFR Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the Foothills, and beyond. And that was Dan Bakker, an investigative journalist. And he was talking about the salmon outlook, the salmon fisheries outlook for 2023. You've been listening to the North State Water Report, and now it's time for Planetary Radio.
Canada's building its first lunar rover, this week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah Al-Ahmed of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. The Canadian Space Agency is upping their moon game with their upcoming lunar rover. After years of testing and deliberation, a company named Canadensis Aerospace Corporation has won the contract to build it. Peter Vischer, the director of Canadensis West, joins us to discuss the rover's mission and design. And we'll let you know what to look for in the night sky in this week's What's Up with Bruce Betts. I'd like to apologize up front for being a bit croaky during the show. Unfortunately, I contracted COVID and recorded most of this before my first positive test. I promise I'll rest up so I can be back to share the wonders of space exploration with you in future weeks. Now for some space mission briefings. China's Zhurong Mars rover appears to be facing challenges. Images from NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter show that the rover has not moved since at least September 2022. Zhurong was expected to autonomously resume activities around December after a planned hibernation during the Martian winter. The Chinese government has not provided any public updates on the state of the mission. The European Space Agency is planning an in-space asteroid hunting mission. The proposed mission, called NEOMIR, would send a spacecraft to a stable orbit between the Earth and the Sun, allowing it to spot asteroids coming from the direction of the Sun. Details of the mission are currently being fleshed out, with a 2030 target launch date. A NASA safety panel has raised concerns about Artemis. The annual report from the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel stated a concern that NASA's concerted attention to a healthy safety culture may have diminished, leaving NASA vulnerable to some flaws that contributed to previous failures. The panel also pointed out that the irregular cadence of Artemis missions and the changing nature of each mission could lead to challenges, essentially making every new mission a test mission. You can learn more about these and other stories in the February 24th edition of our weekly newsletter, The Downlink. Read it or subscribe to have it sent to your inbox for free every Friday at planetary.org/downlink. For the first time in history, Canada is sending a rover to the moon. In November 2022, the Canadian government announced it awarded a $43 million contract to Canadensis Aerospace Corporation to build the first Canadian lunar rover. It's part of an ongoing collaboration between the Canadian Space Agency and NASA. It will fly as part of NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services Initiative and could land in the south polar region of the moon as early as 2026. The rover's mission is to search for water ice in the lunar soil. Past observations have shown evidence that there may be water ice in this region, primarily in the permanently shadowed craters at the South Pole. The upcoming Canadian rover, along with other future missions, aims to learn more. Peter Vischer, our guest this week, is the director of Canadensis West and has been working on the lunar rover for years. He's here to give us the details. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Planetary Radio.
Hi, Sarah. Nice to meet you.
I want to say congratulations to you and all of your colleagues at Canadensis for winning this contract with the Canadian Space Agency to build the first Canadian lunar rover. That's got to be so exciting.
Oh, yeah, it's very exciting. We worked pretty hard to get here. We were awarded the contract, and now reality is setting in, and we actually have to build something. So,
yeah. And Canada has aspired to be more involved in lunar exploration for quite a while. And in order to accomplish that, they created this LEAP program, the Lunar Exploration Accelerator Program. Can you tell us a little bit about what that program is and how your company got involved?
Sure. So the Canadian Space Agency, they started that program after Canada got involved with the Lunar Gateway. It was a fund designed to help small to medium-sized companies participate in the exploration of space, particularly as we try to explore the moon. So the fund was about $150 million. Under that, there was multiple projects that they were pursuing. And one of the main projects in that LEAP portfolio of projects was this small lunar rover project that we've been looking at for a few years.
Did you have aspirations to build a rover before you heard about this program? Or was it something where you heard that this was the goal and you wanted to be part of it?
I have ate, slept, and breathed rovers for 15 years now and have done multiple prototypes for the Canadian Space Agency. Canadensis has been involved with lunar rovers since the very beginning of the company. However, we recognize that participating with space agencies is critical to get some of these projects off the ground.
Mm-hmm. And how did you personally first become excited about building lunar rovers?
Well, that's a bit of a long story. I mean, I grew up as a farmer. I lived on the farm till I was, you know, about 26, 27. Then after I got married, I was told that I should go back to school and become an engineer. So at the time, I was a potato farmer. And looking back, I realize now I was just as close to being a real life Mark Watney as you could find. So I ended up going through for mechanical engineering, and I really enjoyed that. And then in my first year on the job, out of nowhere, we were designing off-road vehicles, and somebody asked if we'd like to help out with a lunar rover project. At the time, my boss wasn't that interested in it, but I was. So I ended up taking that project on and been doing that ever since.
That sounds like so much fun. I mean, to go from dreaming of this thing to participating in the program to actually get it done for the first time, that's an amazing journey. And over 40 different companies and universities have participated in this program to try to build this rover. And in the end, your company was awarded the contract. So what was the competitive process like for this?
The space agency wanted this to be a competitive process. So they put out a RFP, so request for proposal, and they awarded two companies a chance to do a phase A. Now, phase A is a concept study. It's the early part of the program. So our company was awarded one of them, and then Canada's biggest space company called MDA, they were awarded the other one. For the next year, we competed, I guess, and put together our best effort, finished up that project. And at the end of it, the space agency went and looked at what we had both done and then made a decision.
What's fascinating to me about this rover is that it's not just any lunar rover. We've sent vehicles to the moon before, but this rover is going to be adventuring to a part of the moon that no mission has actually gone to before. It's going to touch down on the surface at the moon's south pole and study a region that's just fascinating to me personally for a lot of reasons. But can you tell us why is studying this particular region of the moon so crucial to future space exploration?
Previous landings on the moon, whether it was with a robotic vehicle or whether it was actually with humans back in the Apollo era, they were focused on more of the equatorial regions, kind of the middle part of the moon. And they didn't find a whole lot. They found rocks. That was cool. They found, you know, dirt, like the regolith. But there wasn't really anything super exciting there. But over the next 30, 40 years, you know, especially in the last 15, 20 years, there's been enough satellites that have been sent up around the moon. One thing they found was that in the polar regions of the moon, especially the South Pole, there's a pretty strong hydrogen signature. If you're seeing hydrogen on the moon, it can only be in a couple different forms. And one of those forms is water ice. We can see this from orbit, but we don't really know what form it's in. And we don't really know how deep it is or how we can get it out. So we're going to go in for a closer look. And we're not the only mission targeted at the South Pole. NASA's sending a much larger rover called Viper. This is a program that we've worked with over the last 15 years as well. We're not involved with it at this point, but we're happy to see it finally flying. And it's going to, you know, actually drill down into the ground. With our mission, we won't be drilling into the ground. We'll be using a bunch of different sensors to try to detect different temperature gradients and then also figure out, based on what we find there, we'll go in for a closer look and see if we can actually detect hydrogen.
I hope so. I hope that signal is actually from water ice, because that could be so useful for future space exploration. I mean, not just to keep our astronauts alive when we send them there, but potentially for fuel to get to Mars and beyond. I mean, whatever this rover discovers could be very pivotal to the future of space exploration. Can you tell us a little bit about the rover's design and what it could tell us about water on the moon?
The rover, it's not a huge rover. It's about 30 kilograms, and that includes about 6 kilograms of the sensors, of the payloads that we're supposed to carry. One of them comes from NASA. It'll be looking for these temperature gradients. We call it 50 shades of cold as a nickname. But it looks into these permanently shadowed regions, and it tries to figure out where the coldest areas are, and it can see pretty far out, so it helps us decide where we're going to drive. The other instruments, they're called multispectral. They send a certain light down to the surface, and then they read what's coming back, and using that we can tell what the composition of the ground is. The rover itself, it's not a very big rover, as I mentioned, but one of the interesting things about it, we're going to attempt to survive lunar night. The sun sets and rises every 14 days, so it's a 28-day cycle on the moon. So the sun comes up, and then 14 days later, the sun goes down, and it stays down for 14 days. It varies a bit depending on where you are. But the short and long of it is that it gets very cold at night. There's no sunlight to help charge your batteries. And it's so cold that we have to provide a little bit of heat to some of the instruments and some of the batteries just to keep them alive. This rover is designed to do that. It'll be one of the smallest rovers ever to try to do this. But we're quite confident we're going to be able to pull that off.
What's the rover's power source?
So it's all solar powered. The rover looks kind of like a pyramid with the top chopped off. So it's got, you know, kind of four sides and then a flat top on the top there. And each of the sides, we put as many solar cells on as we can, try to collect as much power as we can. And then we have a battery on board that's as big as we can make it. And that's the only power source. Some of the larger rovers would use an RTG, like a radioisotope heat source. And from that, they can produce both heat and they can produce power. But those are generally for larger rovers. Something as small as ours, we're going to have to rely strictly on solar power.
Mm-hmm. Which is extra challenging when you're not only dealing with the night and day cycle on the moon, but also a lot of the ice that has been previously found in this location is buried down in these permanently shadowed craters on the moon that never get any light at all. So is the rover going to delve into some of these craters, or is it going to stay at the edges so it doesn't necessarily get trapped down there?
Well, I guess it depends who's driving. So these permanently shadowed regions at the South Pole, because the sun angle is so low, they might not require a particularly deep crater to be termed a permanently shadowed region. So we are intending to drive into one of those. So it'll be daylight, and we're going to find a permanently shadowed region using sensors, and then we're going to attempt to drive into it and take more readings. Once we're into it, we have to take those readings reasonably quickly, and then we have to get out. It's going to be as cold as about minus 200, maybe minus 220 Celsius.
Oof.
So this is only about 40, 50 degrees above absolute zero. So we're not going to stay in there very long, and it's going to be a challenge to get all the components to be able to survive that kind of temperature.
You said the Viper rover has plans to kind of dig beneath the surface. Will this rover have any capacity for actually kind of, you know, brushing away the topsoil or getting underneath?
We won't have a drill or any other instruments like that. Because we have to survive lunar night, most of our mass, or a lot of our mass, is dedicated just to keeping us alive. Mm-hmm. However, there's lots of tricks you can do with just using your wheels. So if you want to dig down, you know, 3, 4, 5 centimeters, we have a skid steer design. So we don't actually, the wheels don't pivot like on a car. We just spin one side faster than the other side. So we can actually turn on the spot and do a couple loops like that. And that would dig us down about 5 centimeters. So if we want to see what's just below the surface, we can actually do that.
And that's really clever. That's a good way to repurpose those wheels. Of course, this leads me to another question, which is that the moon is covered in this very abrasive, clingy dust. How is the rover going to deal with this? And you know, are the rover wheels designed in some way to help get this gook out of the wheels if they get clogged?
Yeah, it's been a challenge for lunar exploration since the Apollo era. It's one of the things the astronauts mentioned right off the bat. They said this dust is really sticky. It's getting everywhere and starting to jam up the mechanisms. So every mechanism designed for the lunar surface, a great deal of attention has to be paid to make sure it does not get destroyed by this dust. So we've been practicing for about 10 years with a lunar regolith simulant. It's a type of dust that we make here on Earth, but it's designed to act a lot like the dust that's on the moon. And so we've taken these wheels and we've taken drivetrains and we've put them inside of a vacuum chamber with dust, and we've just run them for a week or 2 weeks even in a vacuum chamber just to see what happens. And can we make the seals good enough? Do the wheels wear out? We've also taken this dust and put it in a much larger facility, and we've driven on it for about 600 kilometers with a pair of wheels. And then we did it again at 2,000 kilometers. So we've been practicing a lot with this dust. And so we're pretty confident that both our wheel design and our mechanisms will be able to survive.
In order to test these things, I'm sure you've built many different prototypes, not just of, you know, different parts of it, but have you built the entire rover all together and started playing around with it yet?
Yes, we've got how many prototypes? I'm trying to think. Yeah. I suppose over the years, we've built about 15 prototypes. Mm-hmm. Most recently, we've built prototypes that are about the same size and roughly the same shape. They look quite a lot like the one that's going to fly, and they have most of the same components. Of course, we're not using flight-grade components yet, because that would make the prototypes very expensive and take a long time to put together. But it's still good to get something that's about the same size so we can start driving it around and learning how to do navigation, learning about the, you know, the drivetrains and the wheels, and about the solar system, the solar array. We have a small indoor test area that we use for demonstrations, and we can set the lighting just right. It's a big sandbox, basically, with a light that's really low in the sky, so it simulates the sun at the South Pole. And it's quite different than driving outside because the shadows are so strange. But it's something we need to practice with so the operators can learn how to drive using just the cameras.
How many people are operating this?
Well, when it actually goes on the surface of the moon, I suspect there'll be a team of probably about 5 to 10 people. There's obviously the person doing the driving. There's someone helping figure out where it needs to go. But of course, there'll be a science team that's helping out, trying to identify points of interest. And then there'll be an engineering team that's needed to provide advice on what it can do and what it can't do. So, you know, you see all the space movies and you see all the people sitting in a control room, you know, with all 50, 60 of them. Well, it won't be quite that many, but there'll still be a team of people sitting around at consoles helping guide this thing.
Yeah, this is the moment that it all gets real. You have to start thinking about staffing, actually building this thing. And I've heard that it's supposed to be launching in 2026, which seems like it's coming up really fast. Is everything still on target for that launch date?
Well, if it seems like it's coming up fast for you, can you imagine how we feel?
I know.
Yeah, everything's on target. I mean, we started this project at the Phase B, so we were awarded the big contract in November. So it's really not that long ago. We've got certain gates we have to pass, and so far everything's on track, but a lot of things have to come together. NASA's providing the lander, and it's Eclipse lander, so that's a commercial lander. So NASA doesn't build it. They put out contracts and allow other companies to build these landers. So that lander has to be, you know, selected and a few details cleaned up on it. Like, we have to figure out how to put the rover on it, you know, how to get the rover off of it. That's another issue.
Yeah.
And we have a U.S. instrument provided by NASA that has to be on schedule, as well as all the other instruments. So it's a lot of project management going on in the background to keep everything on track. But so far, so good.
It's all coming together. This rover is an exciting next step in Canada's exploration of the moon, but this isn't the last step. Canada also, as you said, has involvement with the Lunar Gateway and also with the upcoming Artemis missions. So can you tell us a little bit about what Canada's next steps on the moon are after this rover?
Well, I hope it's more rovers. We're currently involved with some projects where we are producing concepts for both larger rovers, a rover similar to the one we're currently building, but, you know, larger with common features, stuff where we can do development very quickly and try to grow Canada's presence on the lunar surface. We expect if there's ever going to be a human settlement there, you know, something like what they do in the Antarctica, we suspect that there'll be the need for rovers that can drive around and maybe, you know, move some of the regolith around to build berms, to build landing pads, build some of the infrastructure needed to sustain human life. The other thing is, it's not just the water that we need to find and extract it. We need to turn that water into, obviously, air, oxygen. We can turn it to rocket fuel. But we also need water if we're ever going to grow plants on the lunar surface. So we also have a project on the go where we're learning how to build a greenhouse and produce crops. That's all going to require rovers to help out with that for mobility. Just for, you know, can you imagine a construction site without a telehandler or a forklift or something like that? It's just, you wouldn't even try to do it.
No, but, you know, maybe with enough missions there, we can get enough stuff there to build these things. But we're probably going to have to go one of those routes where we 3D print buildings or dig underneath the ground, something like that, because there's no way. I can't even imagine how many centuries it'll be until we have a forklift on the moon.
Yeah, well, some of the rover designs are designed to move equipment around, right? So using the basic architecture of our rover, we can design larger ones that can do different things. So that's going to be pretty interesting. You made a comment there about we have to do some 3D printing and use what's there. So that's like the main drive behind a lot of the work we do. It's called in situ resource utilization. Of course, that's NASA speak for use what you find there. So trying to figure out how to turn the lunar dust into things that we can use, whether we extract the titanium out and then we can build tools or hardware, even just using the regolith to build a habitat. It takes about, I think, between 1 and 2 meters of regolith to shield, to properly shield the astronauts from the radiation. So if you're going to put someone there for a long period of time, they need to be either in a building that has very thick walls or maybe even underground. Mm-hmm. So a lot to learn there yet.
Yeah. Once we can nail it down on the moon, maybe we can then go on to Mars.
Yep.
I know people are very excited about getting humans to Mars, but it really has to happen on the moon first if we're going to make sure that we do it safely.
That's very, very true. There's no sense planning a human settlement or even a trip to Mars unless we learn what we have to learn from doing it on the moon. And the same way we've learned how to do a lot of the stuff in Antarctica, we'll take a lot we learned there and use it to explore the moon and hopefully learn enough there so eventually we can head off to the red planet.
Yep. Well, this is just the first step in a much bigger thing. It's really exciting. And every different nation that gets involved in space exploration just makes me so happy. And there's so many different potentials for collaboration. So I'm really happy to talk about this with you. Thanks for joining me, Peter.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And good luck to you and your team. You've got a lot coming up for you in the future.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's going to be a busy few years.
You can hear the extended version of my interview with Peter Vischer, the director of Canadensis West, in the podcast and online version of this show at planetary.org/radio. You can also listen to it anywhere you find your favorite podcasts. We'll be right back for What's Up after this short break.
Hello, I'm George Takei, and as you know, I'm very proud of my association with Star Trek. Star Trek was a show that looked to the future with optimism, boldly going where no one had gone before. I want you to know about a very special organization called the Planetary Society. They are working to make the future that Star Trek represents a reality. Boldly go to build our future.
There is so much going on in space science and exploration, and we're here to share it with you. Hi, I'm Amber, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society. Catch the latest space exploration news, pretty planetary pictures, and Planetary Society publications on our social media channels. You can find the Planetary Society on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube. I hope you'll like and subscribe so you never miss the next exciting update from the world of planetary science.
And now it's time for What's Up with Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Sarah. How are you feeling?
Well, you know, I went to a Doctor Who convention and came home with the con crud, but I'm getting better. Thanks.
Ugh, alien con crud. Anyway, I'm sorry not feeling well. I will try to carry this segment, but feel free to be entertaining if you wish.
I'll do my best.
All right, I will go ahead and start with what's up in the night sky, which is, I'm just going to keep saying it. Venus, super bright. Jupiter, really bright. Both over in the west after sunset. Can't miss them. Certainly can't miss Venus. Jupiter and Venus will be right next to each other within a full moon's width as this show comes out on March 1st. Then Jupiter will start dropping lower and lower towards the horizon, but they'll still make a magnificent sight. And then you can follow a line between them and head up to the high in the sky and check out Mars looking reddish. Mars is hanging out near a bunch of great constellations and bright stars, including Orion, brightest star in the sky, Sirius, the winter hexagon. Sorry, Southern Hemisphere people, but that's what they've nicknamed it, which is an asterism of, not surprisingly, six very bright stars that cover a big portion of the sky. Anyway, lots of good stuff to look at in the area of Mars, and that's what I got in the sky. Let me tell you about this week in space history, or at least a couple tiny things. Well, okay, they weren't tiny. 1969, Apollo 9 launched the test of the free-flying lunar module in Earth orbit. It just is amazing to me that that occurred in March and Apollo 11 landed on the moon in July, and they fit Apollo 10 in between those two.
That's bonkers. I feel like, if we can accomplish that, we can definitely get to Artemis 2, at least in the next couple years.
Here's hoping. 10 years later, Voyager 1 passed by Jupiter and gave us our first really good views, although pioneers had gone through before, first really good views of the Jupiter system, including its intriguing moons. Off I go to random space fact. So I thought this was fun. I just discovered that there are a set of craters on Mercury that look like Mickey Mouse, which you can probably find a lot of hidden Mickeys in the solar system with craters. This one, really looks like the canonical Mickey Mouse. And what's really interesting is it is officially named, the largest of the craters is named Disney, after Walt Disney. The IAU officially approved it. This was discovered by the Messenger mission. And so there is a 113-kilometer diameter crater with crater friends that look like Mickey Mouse named Disney on Mercury.
I didn't know that.
By the way, it fit nicely because craters on Mercury are named after artists, musicians, painters, and authors.
That's awesome. I'll have to look up a picture of that.
I mean, it doesn't look exactly like Mickey Mouse. They're craters just to temper your expectations, but it's pretty cool. Anyone who's played the hidden Mickey game at Disneyland or Disney World or elsewhere will immediately recognize the pattern. On to the trivia contest, and I asked you, as of February 15th, 2023, of the people on board the International Space Station, who has had the most space flights? What you got?
Almost everyone got this one correct, because this person definitely set a record. The answer is JAXA astronaut Koichi Wakata, and our winner this week is Torsten Zimmer from Gesche, Germany. He wrote us to say that this was true about Koichi, but also that he's currently on his fifth spaceflight. And during his nearly two decades in spaceflight, he's logged more than 11 months in space. That is impressive.
It is impressive. I'll just clarify it. Technically not a record on the five spaceflights, since there are a couple of people with, I believe, seven. But much more than the other crew who were all on their first or second flight.
And, of course, our winner this week won themselves a Planetary Society beanie. I don't know if it's super cold in Germany. I'm guessing it is, because it is freezing over here in California right now. Freezing. All right. So what's our trivia question for next week, Bruce?
All right. From a robotic sample return mission to the moon, so not a crewed sample return mission, What was the largest mass of samples returned by a single mission? So I'm looking for the largest mass, a number, of samples returned from the moon by a robotic-only sample return mission. Go to planettrade.org/radio contest.
And you have until Wednesday, March 8th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us your answer. And please forgive me, but we're going to be giving out even more Planetary Society beanies because I feel like everyone should be warm and snuggly right now. Maybe it's